Chapter 9. How has macroeconomic policy changed in an era of uncertainty? In this chapter, we will define the term macroeconomics and macroeconomic policy, and we will look at the three main objectives of macroeconomic policy and explain their importance. One of the problems that bedevils modern economies is that far from achieving economic growth in a long-term and stable way, economies often find themselves in a position of short-term economic decline. Economies move through a series of booms and slumps or business cycles. A major focus of the chapter then is looking at whether or not governments can successfully implement stabilization policy to try to iron out the booms and slumps in economies so that we can have stable long-run economic growth rates. Inevitably, there is a debate about the degree to which governments are able to do this. We will look at both sides of the so-called stabilisation policy debate. We will explain how the UK's macroeconomic policy framework has been informed by this continuing debate over stabilisation policy. And finally, in the chapter, we will explore the implications of Brexit for macroeconomic policy going forward. But Brexit is an issue that we will return to in much more detail in Chapter 13. In relation then to macroeconomic policy, it's commonly accepted that there are three major objectives. These being to maintain a stable and satisfactory rate of economic growth, a high and stable level of employment, and a low and stable rate of inflation. As we saw in Chapter 3, there are two ways of looking at economic growth. We can look at economic growth in the long term or in the short term. In the long term, it's widely acknowledged that there are four main factors which determine a country's capacity to efficiently produce in the long run. It's investment in physical capital, factories, machinery. It's investment in human capital, the education, skills and training of labour, of people. The application of new technologies, and in Chapter 3 we explored the debates about the type of business environment which will promote successful technological development, and its endowment in natural resources. In Chapter 8 we explored the possible conflict then between economic growth and environmental sustainability. As we saw in Chapter 3, the debate about economic growth itself is contentious, veering between those people that very much place their faith in the efficacy of markets and those people that argue that if markets are going to work, they need to be supported by a raft of institutional institutions which can provide institutional sophistication and institutional reliability for markets to operate effectively. However, the problem in the short term which bedevils economies is this tendency for economies to lurch from periods of growth to periods of decline. And therefore, is it possible to try to iron out those problems through effective stabilisation policy? And here, this is a great matter for debate. For many people, while it may be true that governments cannot really claim much credit for long-term growth solely because there are other things that come into play, they can, though, significantly influence the pattern of growth in the short term. Whether or not they should try to do this, though, is a highly controversial matter in macroeconomics. Let's turn our attention to unemployment. Firstly, why is unemployment a problem? Well, this should be fairly easy for you to deduce. If we argue, as we do in Chapter 2, that the starting point of economics and business activity is the problem of scarcity, then if there are unemployed resources, whether that be capital resources, natural resources or human resources, then that just seems to be a catastrophic waste of economic potential. But of course, unemployment particularly is a tragedy for people. If people, individuals are unemployed, that means they're not able to support themselves and their families. Unemployment, therefore, is personally an economic problem, but socially it's an economic problem. Those people will need looking after. That will involve large amounts of transfer benefits from the government to private individuals. Wouldn't it be better if those people working in the first place? And it's argued that there are a wide range of social costs associated with unemployment, people feeling disassociated from society, wide range of health problems and general problems of poverty and deprivation that result from unemployment. When we look at unemployment, we need to distinguish between types of unemployment. There's frictional unemployment, structural unemployment, and demand deficient unemployment, and we will consider what those different definitions of unemployment in the chapter. What about inflation? Why is inflation a problem? Well, firstly, what is inflation? Inflation is a process of continually rising prices. We saw in chapter 2 that if markets are going to work correctly and we have sensible allocative, productive and distributive decisions, then we need to have an efficient price functioning system. Inflation gets in the way of the signalling mechanism of prices and can distort price signals, meaning very often then we will get the wrong types of goods being produced. Firms won't really know be able to make sensible production decisions because they won't be able to predict with any certainty what their costs are going to be or indeed what their future prices are going to be. Inflation may arbitrarily redistribute income and wealth across different groups in society, having distribution issues. And in terms of international competitiveness, inflation can erode a country's ability to compete internationally if inflation is artificially increasing the prices of its goods. Ultimately, then, you will see that inflation can pose a very real and present danger to the economic prospects of an economy. Let's turn our attention then back to growth and stabilisation policy in the short term. Stabilisation policy involves attempts by authorities to stabilise the levels of output and unemployment. This approach was first developed by John Maynard Keynes in response to the Great Depression of the 1930s. Monetarist economists, led by Milton Friedman, subsequently argued that governments could not affect output and employment except in the short term. Moreover, they argued that stabilisation policy would fuel inflation. And this is the debate then which dominates the debate about macroeconomic policy between those people that have faith in the ability of governments to stabilise the economy and those people who argue that ultimately government intervention will not only not work but will actually be positively detrimental to the efficient functioning of economies both in the short run and the long run. In the Keynesian view, according to the late Nobel Prize winning economist Franco Modigliani, what Keynes had outlined in his most famous book, The General Theory of Employment, Interest and Money, was the following: need, can, should case for stabilisation policy. What Modigliani means by this is that governments need to stabilise the economy. Capitalist economies have a tendency to slip easily into recession. They are inherently unstable. Governments can stabilise the economy. They have the requisite fiscal and monetary tools, and governments should therefore stabilise the economy. There is no case for them not to do so. In the monetarist view, though, as exemplified by the work of Milton Friedman, stabilisation policy is precisely the opposite to Modigliani's. Governments don't need to stabilise the economy. Capitalist economies are inherently stable unless disturbed by erratic monetary growth. Governments cannot stabilise the economy. Fiscal and monetary policy are ineffective in tackling unemployment and stimulating output in the long run. Governments should not, therefore, try to stabilise the economy. There is no case for them to do so. We saw in Chapter 2 that in the late 1970s onwards, in the UK and other major capitalist economies, what came to predominate the view of economic thinking was a belief then in neoliberalism, in a belief in the free market system. In our modern era, in the 21st century, these types of free market policies have become, particularly at the macroeconomic level, have become referred to then as austerity. Austerity as a macroeconomic policy means that the government manages fiscal policy to balance income from taxes and public expenditure. Austerity has dominated UK macroeconomic policy between 2010 and 2016 as the government attempted to unwind what it saw as the deficit spending, in other words, government spending far more than they are raising in taxation, deficit spending of previous governments. Austerity requires contractionary fiscal policy adjustments, cuts in public expenditure and tax increases, but usually with a strong emphasis on the former, to try to ensure that government lives within its means. Following the outcome of the Brexit referendum in 2016 and the need to counter any ensuing demand shock to the economy, it has been argued recently that there is a need for greater flexibility in the conduct of fiscal policy. However, it remains to be seen the extent to which that will happen in the future. We've talked about Brexit, so finally then we must consider the implications of Brexit for macroeconomic policy, particularly in the context of the UK. As we will see in Chapter 13, Brexit means the UK leaving the European Union. The UK has been a member of the European Union since 1973. What is it then the UK is leaving? Well, in economic terms, the most important element is the European single market, a unique economic space in which goods and services from all EU countries are freely traded and between which people and firms may move and do business unhindered. The single market is the world's richest market and offers great opportunities to export, invest and pursue personal ambitions. Almost half of UK goods exports are sold in the single market. So why then is the UK leaving? Most of the arguments for leaving turn on the UK's ambitions to act independently in an economic and a political sense. Outside the single market, it's argued the UK will be able to police immigration in a way that is not possible with the free movement of people that membership of the single market demands. The UK will also be able to reach independent trade agreements with other countries inside the single market, whereas inside the single market, trade arrangements are managed for all members as a group. What's likely to happen as a result of the UK leaving the European Union? Well, at the time of this edition of the book and at the time of the recording of this podcast, it will very much depend on the way in which the UK leaves. A so-called hard Brexit, in which access to the single market is lost, poses a threat. The UK's largest market would become more difficult to access, with no guarantee that lost trade with the EU would be easily replaced by increased trade with other economies. A soft Brexit, which retains access to the single market after the UK has left the EU, would have an extremely positive effect on confidence in the UK economy. The longer-term implications of Brexit are likely to turn on the outcome of the exit negotiations.